This is Ukraine Calling.
Ukraine Calling is again with you. This is the podcast of the Romanske Radio in Kyiv. I'm Andriy Kulikov, and our guest today is a person thinking of whom I always remember that his official title for some time used to be His Excellency. Because this is an excellent conversationalist, an excellent guest, Roman Vaščuk. He's now Ukraine's business ombudsman, and in very responsible times he used to be Canada's ambassador plenipotentiary and
extraordinary
and plenipotentiary to Ukraine. And of course, in some very official cases, he had to be addressed as His or Your Excellency.
You're encouraging me to rise above mediocrity in this conversation.
Very good. I think that our audience will appreciate this. By the way, Roman, you are a figure of Ukrainian folklore, because one of the legends I heard about you is that you were very instrumental in Canada recognizing Ukraine's independence as swiftly as it happened. Is there some ground in this?
In a very junior way, yes. When I came back from my first posting, which was to Moscow, I started working at what was then the Soviet and East European Department of what was then the Department of External Affairs in Canada. And I was the desk officer for the Soviet Union. So when it began to fall apart, and there was a need to write the first draft of the cabinet decision document on recognition of Ukrainian independence, my deputy director, John DeGangi, who had a kind of slightly wicked sense of humor, said, "Roman, I think you would appreciate writing the first draft of this document," which I did. And of course, because cabinet documents in Canada are secret, I don't know if anything was left of my first draft in the final decision document, but I did give it a little start.
As a Ukrainian, as a person who sympathized, I presume, with the Ukrainian struggle for independence, were you sort of having special feelings?
My deputy director was right. I did very much appreciate the opportunity. And frankly, being in that office throughout the late summer and fall and winter of 1991-92. You know, some of my good friends who had stayed at the embassy in Moscow then moved to Kyiv to support the emerging Ukrainian embassy, and they also have very fond memories of sort of getting in on the ground floor.
Roman Vaščuk is our today's guest on Ukraine Calling, and he used to be a very successful and high-ranking Canadian diplomat for several decades?
Yeah, about 32 years, yeah.
Yeah, how had the Canadian policy towards Ukraine changed over these years? And you were, again, instrumental in bringing those changes about.
Or I was an instrument of the changes sometimes.
All right.
I think Canada was always keen to be both be supportive and be seen to be supportive. We had a domestic constituency that was very interested in our relationship with Ukraine. I think you mentioned that we were nearly the first to recognize Ukraine's independence.
Okay, the first Poland, far, far away to the West.
Yes. What we would call those countries considered to be Western countries in 1991. Now, the Poles would disagree with that categorization, but because of the time difference, they managed to get in a few hours earlier. I think we've generally paid quite a lot of attention to the relationship. We've had, in many respects, a less Russo-centric policy, although, again, there's a strong inertia in every government. When you have a big embassy in a place like Moscow, it continues to exert a lot of influence, even when the relationship is no longer so close or even so important. I think 2014-15, very active. Also, I'd say on the cutting edge of hashtags and tweets. I've seen the Russia, not Russia graphic, which actually was designed by an intern at our embassy, at our mission to NATO in 2014. It keeps popping up over and over again. It's maybe the strongest Canadian policy statement ever made graphically, and it was done by an intern. So there's that. Then, of course, Operation Unifier, police training. So a lot of practical things that people may not have fully appreciated at the time, because both Ukrainians are skeptics about change in their own country.
Wherever they are?
Yeah, I said, but most skeptical of all in Ukraine itself. And then, you know, people assessing from outside also can be led astray by Ukrainian skepticism. And so you have this situation now where clearly everyone is surprised by how well the Ukrainian army has performed.
But you certainly are not surprised, or you are as well.
No, so I was about to say that I am in the tiny minority of unsurprised people, because I would visit various locations of Operation Unifier and its training mission with the Ukrainian forces, to the extent that one of the rotations gave me this plaque titled Combat Ambassador. But no, I'm a non-combatant, you'll be reassured to know. And I could see how the relationships were being built, how the mentality of the Ukrainian partners was changing. A lot of it just through plain old conversations, eating the same meals together. The fact that a lot of the soldiers stayed in touch, you know, through social media or otherwise after their tour of duty in Ukraine, the Canadians. I mean, it's significant that, for example, two past commanders of Operation Unifier are the senior advisors to one of the big funds that is helping to procure non-lethal equipment, especially drones and other things for the Ukrainian armed forces. So these are people who, through their mission, through their training mission, developed a deep appreciation for and commitment to Ukraine as military, as policing colleagues. And frankly, a lot of them, I think, in the initial weeks and months, felt a bit of guilt about not being able to directly help their Ukrainian comrades. But they've gotten over it by undertaking all of these supportive measures and activities and being part of, if you will, the deep field presence, you know, sort of back on kind of a reserve front, supporting the Ukrainian forces.
Mr. Vashuk, when you became Canada's ambassador to Ukraine, how did your experience of working in Moscow help you to deal with Ukraine?
And the experience of working in Belgrade. I came to Kyiv directly from Belgrade.
I'd been Canadian
ambassador in Belgrade, also responsible for Macedonia, now North Macedonia, and Montenegro. You know, I was in Moscow at a time of hope in Russia, when there was more than one Khoroshi Ruski out on Red Square at a time. But also, I could see that the imperial mindset was very much there and could come back. What my experience in Belgrade showed me was the fact that when you are the former center of a federation that falls apart, but a federation that was a bigger country that made you feel important, you saw things very differently from the way people saw it in Skopje or Podgorica, in other words, the, if you will, liberated parts that...
Wasn't Podgorica Titograd at that time?
It was Titograd. I think the airport is still TGD in terms of its code. So this kind of former metropolis and then liberated former colony or former part of the state... So I was able to see it in two different locations. some things are the same, some things are different. But actually, the Balkan experience I found particularly helpful because for me, it didn't come with any of my own emotional family or historical baggage. And so maybe it was even more of an objective appreciation of the difference between the central perspective and the ex-periphery perspective on things. Plus, the Balkans was a region that had gone through a big conflict a decade earlier, decade and a half, than I was there. I was there 2011, 2014. And so you could, to some extent, model the psychological trajectory of both the attackers and the defenders. Interestingly, Serbs were quite keen on forgetting the 90s.
Maybe because of the feeling of guilt?
Partly, not wanting to revisit their own memories or feelings, in a sense of, let's just get over it. Croatians, not so keen on moving on. So what happens often, I think, is the people who help touch off the war no longer want to talk about why they did it or how they did it afterwards. Those whose identity was forged in defending the homeland against the initiators and perpetrators, they hold on to that memory for much longer. And so if Putin were to be run over by a tank tomorrow, I would expect that in 5-10 years, Russians would say, it wasn't us, or, it was sad, hugely unfortunate, but let's just get over it. But I don't see Ukrainians getting over this identity forging experience for decades and decades and decades.
In an aside about your stay in or your tenure in Belgrade, did you have to deal with the Ukrainian or Russian minority in Vojvodina?
I did, indeed. I was often a guest on radio, both Russian and Ukrainian radio and television. Very interesting micro communities, very active, proportionate to their size. I mean, the entire sort of Ukrainian, identifying as Ukrainian community, 4,500 people, with 6 cultural societies, 6...
And different views on whether they speak a special language,
right,
or
yeah,
a dialect,
oh,
or Ukrainian.
The Rusyn, certainly, yes. But you have also this very interesting thing that in former Yugoslav terms, or now in Serbian Vojvodinian terms, the Rusyns are the bigger group. And the Ukrainians are concerned about separateness from the bigger group. But in a global sense, of course, the Rusyns are a tiny group compared to Ukrainians in the homeland or globally. So there's a kind of micro set of feelings and then a more macro set of feelings. I met lots of very interesting people. And again, people who are able to live in, because they've lived in both contexts, compare the two situations. I mean, you've probably met people like Mikhail Ramach, Boris Varga, who are certainly in the sort of Serbian language sphere and the post-Yugoslav sphere, very important commentators in their own right, nothing to do with their Rusyn background or their affinities for Ukraine. But I found, and I recommend it often for people wanting to talk about what's happening in Ukraine, give it context, that talking to them offers a very interesting perspective that is often missing in commentary.
When you came to Ukraine as an ambassador, did you ever had a feeling that Ukrainians are in minority in their own country?
Well, interesting that you should say that. I had a feeling that I was almost like a dual ambassador to some extent. I was an ambassador of, obviously, of Canada and of all Canadians. And I made a point of this, that not just some diaspora, but, from coast to coast to coast, including Canada's Indigenous people, Canadians of all backgrounds, but also because of my family background, as a sort of Mohican of a sort of previous generations whose legacy had largely been marginalized in Ukraine itself. What's been interesting to see over the last decade is how things have shifted. I mean, I have to say, you know, coming back now, even compared to 6 months ago, you sort of wonder, like, where did all these Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians come from that you see in this, you know, ordering food or wandering the streets or shopping in Kyiv today? I think the answer is they were kind of there all along, except not expressing themselves necessarily publicly because they were suffering cultural cringe from the previous dominant Russian post-Soviet culture. But since I've, you know, come from an officially bilingual and multicultural country myself, and I've worked in all these other environments, I also didn't feel that an incredibly kind of militant, guilt-inducing approach to language or cultural issues necessarily works terribly well. People need to be encouraged, and regulation needs to be put in place that encourages the right outcomes. I have to say that at one point, I guess it was 2018, 2019, when the updated language law was being debated, there were attempts to kind of instrumentalize the G7 ambassadors to stop it from being adopted. I invited my old friend Mykola Knyazhitsky, who was head of the committee in charge of the legislation, and he sort of contextualized it for my colleagues and explained, you know, that it wasn't blanket, that it was that it was actually based on a number of other countries' approaches to language use issues, and that helped create a more balanced view of what they had in mind. And now, of course, President Putin has disrupted the balance and radicalized individual Ukrainians beyond what any law might have tried to encourage them to do.
Roman Vashuk is our guest speaker today on Ukraine Calling, and he used to be Canada's ambassador to Ukraine during very responsible years. And since the beginning of the Russian invasion into Ukraine, and I mean 2014 in this case, not only the 24th of February 2022, Canada was behind Ukraine, Canada was next to Ukraine. But some people would say, of course, because Ukraine's resistance damages Russia. And that's not because Canadians love Ukraine so much. It's because they want to inflict as much damage at Russia as the West generally. In this respect, by the way, I remember a Canadian group called Arrogant Worms, whose song says, "We're the second biggest country on the planet Earth, and if Russia keeps on shrinking, we'll become the first." So how much Canada is interested in shrinking Russia, and how much is it interested in upholding Ukraine's fight for independence?
I hate to tell you, but the Arrogant Worms are not prominent Canadian policymakers. Most Canadians, and certainly Canadian politicians, don't think in those kind of terms. There may be countries where people think like that, but it's not Canada. We're too live and let live for that. So I would say the Canadian policy is actually driven by positive feelings about and to Ukraine. So, and in fact, there's a sort of reluctance. I mean, everyone is willing to condemn Russian aggression, but to be strident in it somehow feels to most people un-Canadian, that you need to leave maybe a little space for dialogue, or you don't want to sound like you're really clanking those weapons, even if you're, I think we prefer to actually ship weapons more quietly and not appear to be too militaristic or gung-ho as a country. Now, that doesn't mean individual Canadians or individual Canadian alt-rock groups don't express themselves differently.
Speaking of federations and multiculturalism and bilingualism, can we draw some comparisons between the English-speaking and the French-speaking part of Canada in attitude towards Ukraine? Since you were representing all Canadians.
You know, I would say that given past patterns of migration to Canada, there has generally been less understanding and empathy of regarding Ukrainians in Francophone Quebec, just because people didn't meet people of Ukrainian background or listen to their story all that often. And also Quebec is an area where there's a great interest in the Arctic, since Quebec itself has a very large northern component, and a sense that Russia is, if not a partner, then at least unavoidable if you want to get serious about Arctic issues. And also, Quebec is no longer New France, hasn't been for hundreds of years, but Francophones naturally read foreign policy publications and listen to TV and radio from France. So the generally more sort of balanced, let's not take sides too quickly rhetoric we were seeing for a while out of France, that also has an impact, more of an impact in Quebec. But I think what we've seen is a shift. I did quite a lot of French language radio and television in February, March. And then the arrival of the first of thousands of Ukrainian refugees in Montreal and other towns and cities in Quebec has led, I think, to an unprecedented degree of empathy. I saw signs that were put up all over the city of Lévis, which is just south of Quebec City, marking Ukrainian Independence Day and remarking sort of on support for the Ukrainian struggle. This is something that you would have never seen before this year. So I think what is happening as well is that the geography of interest in Ukraine and support for Ukraine is changing. It is broadening. Similarly, on the 24th, there was probably the first big public Ukrainian Independence Day celebration in St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada's easternmost.
With the Cubasonics giving
exactly
a concert.
Right. And there you can see this very interesting sort of melding of traditions. Cubasonics, led by a guy named Brian Cherwick, a descendant of the first wave of Ukrainian immigrants to the prairies. In fact, it is PhD on Ukrainian popular music of the prairies, with a band in what was one of Canada's least immigrant receiving provinces. The Cubasonics, when they moved a couple of years ago, became wildly popular in Newfoundland. With Ukrainian-only material. Nobody wanted their English stuff. They just wanted the Ukrainian stuff. And now...
But it's interspersed with Eastern Coast music.
Yes, exactly. Or it draws on many of the same sort of dancing traditions of reels and jigs that people in a pub in Newfoundland can appreciate. So on the 24th, on George Street, which is the main pedestrian thoroughfare, you had then hundreds of people who had recently arrived from Ukraine this summer in Newfoundland, plus Newfoundlanders who love this music, plus the Cubasonics, all celebrating Ukrainian independence and a big dance too. So that shows how sort of the history of Canada's migration and Ukrainian settlement in Canada and things that happened just a few weeks ago all link together and so far very positively.
On the 24th of August this year, a producer from CBC called me and asked whether I was willing to give a couple of interviews to Canadian radio stations. Of course, I said I will be glad. And it ended in 11 interviews for CBC affiliates in different...
Across the country.
Across the country. So I even got to know a couple of new names, like Kelowna.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all the rest were more or less familiar. And it started with St. Johnson. I heard part of the Cubasonics concerts. That's why I know. But the question is, was it because just because it was the 24th, or the interest in Ukraine spreads more or less evenly across Canada?
It's interesting. And as I say, it's kind of the genie has escaped from the bottle, from Southern Ontario, from the southern part of the prairies, or this belt across the prairies. A Facebook friend of mine who was visiting...
You believe in Facebook friends?
I have met her live and in person, We're also friends on Facebook.
All right.
She and her husband were in small towns on the coast of Vancouver Island. And all sorts of houses and public buildings had Ukrainian flags. And again, these are areas where previously there was not much Ukrainian presence at all. So I think people genuinely empathize. The fact is, Canada, which has become in the last 40, 50 years a very globally multicultural country, nonetheless has strong European roots and fought in two European-centered world wars. So a lot of Canadians have a particular kind of emotional attachment to the images they see out of Ukraine, because the images are very reminiscent of World War II, partly because Russia hasn't evolved out of World War II. The artillery, the displacement of people, the trains, all this sort of stuff. So people feel this kind of visceral attachment that transcends ethnic or other boundaries. I saw a photo yesterday of Free Boutique that some friends of mine, including my sister-in-law, Natalie, helped set up in Toronto. It's called Ukrainian Canadian Parachute. And it's set up like a sort of Winners or TJ Maxx, except it's free for people to come in and pick up what they need, whether it's pots and pans or clothing. But it's arranged to look nice so that you feel like that you're shopping and not getting a donation. But that a woman who appeared to be of Southeast Asian background and her little daughter came, and they donated everything that the daughter had got for her birthday to this shop, because the daughter wanted to help and mother wanted to help displaced Ukrainians. So I think it's an unprecedented time, not just in Canada, but globally, for Ukraine and its profile. It's tragic. It's the price being paid is extremely high. But people around the world will never look at Ukraine the same way again. And I mean that in a very positive manner.
Before we go back to Ukraine for the rest of our conversation, another question pertaining to the attitudes of Ukraine. I rarely watch videos from Russian propagandists, but from time to time I just have to do this to sort of keep abreast of what they are saying. And the message that they've been spreading for quite some time already is, the world has become tired of Ukraine. They do not want to see Ukrainian refugees anymore. They will stop to help them pretty soon, and all this kind of stuff. Canada.
Look, we have had, as of last week, just over 75,000 Ukrainians arrive. Over 200,000 Ukrainians have had Canadian visas issued to them. Now, not all of them are using them. Some of them, I think, because it's a free program, they're thinking this is an insurance policy. I'll get one just in case. Nearly 500,000 have applied. And there's no limit. So you know, the Russians, in this, as in many other things, are just lying. And I can also tell you, as someone who has spent much of the last 6 months in Poland, and occasionally in other parts of Europe, that Ukrainians are seen as high human capital people. And this is one of the rare displacement movements where the host countries are sometimes more interested in keeping the refugees than the refugees are in staying. I was at a panel this summer, Baltic Business Forum, where it was a panel on migration and the Ukrainian movement. There were two researchers there, two of them, two women, and they were Ukrainians living in Poland for a longer time, and they'd been studying the phenomenon, doing polling and surveys. And then there were three representatives of business and of municipalities saying, we are working on incentive programs to try and ensure that some percentage of these people stay. Because, let's say, the Katowice agglomeration, municipal agglomeration, we have identified demographic needs, and a number of these people fit the profile of who we need in our communities. And so nobody is going to send people who are this smart, this well-educated, and this useful to their own societies back against their will, generally. And in fact, as I say, a number of countries are thinking of incentive programs.
So we stopped for a while in Poland on our way to Ukraine. And by the way, I read some Polish analysis which says, in a positive way, which surprised me quite a lot, that Poland is becoming a two-nation country at the moment, because yes. Ukrainians are swiftly approaching almost 12 and then maybe 15% of the population.
In major cities like Wrocław, they're now 30%.
I was in Wrocław, where my grandson was studying, when Ukrainians constituted 10%. And even then, they had inscriptions and signs in Ukrainian next to Polish and German.
Well, right now on program number one of Polish radio, Jedynka, you get, I think it's every second hour, you have the news, and then you have the news in Ukrainian. I think what's characteristic of what is a war, now it's strictly speaking still on Ukrainian territory, but it is a regional war and with global implications, is that things are changing. It changes things in unexpected ways. One of which is, as you say, that Poland, at least temporarily, becoming a binational country. A lot of thoughtful Poles are thinking, how can we manage this situation better than before 1939, realizing mistakes were made before then. And, you know, you have a realignment of European security relationships. You have, within Ukraine, a rebalancing of business from one region, from one set of regions to another. You have Ukrainians who work remotely, continuing to work from wherever they have found temporary shelter, which is very different from what would have happened even 10 years ago. So maintaining their connection to their Ukrainian company or their Ukrainian organization. No, it is fascinating. And I think those of us who are living in it, we aren't always conscious of all the very many impacts it's having.
Roman Vashuk is talking to those who listen to this podcast, Ukraine Calling, on Hromadske Radio. And at the moment, he is Ukraine's business ombudsman. And he spent several very fruitful years in Ukraine as Canada's ambassador. Before talking about your business ombudsman's affairs, a question which has always fascinated me, because it's always applied to, or often applied to, journalists who are somebody's own correspondents in different countries. Yeah. But I have almost never heard this issue raised about the diplomats. Is the issue of becoming native, or going native to the country where you are stationed, of losing the ability to look at this country from your editorial office's point mm-hmm. of view? And does this happen to diplomats, and especially to diplomats like you, who are from a solid Ukrainian stock, mm-hmm. who know the culture, who know mm-hmm. the history, who can speak language immaculately?
The short answer is, after a certain time, yes. I remember one of my former ambassadors in Germany towards the end of her term, and it was, I think, 4 or 5 years, saying, why should I deliver this démarche to the Germans, to our German friends? I mean, these people in Ottawa, they have no idea what they want. And I was thinking, wait a minute, but like the people in Ottawa are paying us. Maybe we should pay some attention to what they want. It's one of the reasons why diplomats get rotated, because you do tend to set down roots and you are overwhelmingly talking to people from your country of accreditation and not from your headquarters. There is a bit of an embassy bubble in each embassy, but nonetheless, if you're at all effective, you're interacting more with the host society. I like to think, and maybe I'm just overestimating my abilities here, that because I had actually done quite a lot of studying of the region, that I also had a certain ability to critically interrogate the Ukrainian side of things as well, not just the country of Ukraine, but my own beliefs in my own background. Now, that doesn't negate emotion, that doesn't negate a certain sense of solidarity, but I think it's helpful for diplomats, probably for journalists too, to always have that little voice somewhere in their head, the editorial voice saying, wait a minute, you're getting caught up in some in sort of the surfing the wave. Again, there are times to critically interrogate, there are times to stay balanced on the surfboard and keep surfing. And I think the last 6 months have been more of a surfing period for people than having huge self-reflection exercises. But yeah, there's a reason why diplomacy is a rotational culture.
A very personal question. You left diplomatic service at a young age, after holding a very responsible position in a very important country. Was it because you had enough of diplomacy, or was it because you saw a good opportunity for yourself to be a business ombudsman in Ukraine?
Well, not at that point, no. I think I got out while the getting was good. You mentioned that I was there during a very responsible period. I have to say, my successor has been through a much more challenging period than I ever experienced. So, and I think she and the current cohort, they are all going to be deserving medals from their from headquarters for managing.
By the way,
do
you have a medal from Ukrainian or Canadian authorities?
Yes and yes, actually, yes. Not very shiny ones, but yeah.
Oh, all right.
So I thought, I thought I'd never really have the same combination of serving in a country that I cared about deeply and where for a long time I had a minister who was very engaged as well, as Chrystia Freeland when she was foreign minister. And I thought, if I go back to headquarters and I'm in charge of, you know, something administrative, you know, I'll just be sitting there saying, it's not like the old days. I had enough years, so I took early retirement, and I thought, end of 2019, hey, travel the world, go to some conferences, do some think tanking, maybe talk to Hromadske Radio, occasionally hit the beach. But then the pandemic hit, and none of that happened. So I spent a lot of time in my basement in our new house in Toronto. I spent some time helping, you know, relatives and other people make it through, work through the pandemic. Did some research on family history. And then I saw this ad and, you know, got a call from some headhunter saying, would you be interested in this job? And I said, well, I'm sitting here in my basement. Maybe this would be more interesting. And so I applied. And that's how I ended up in Kyiv in early January of 2022.
How much time you needed to grow into this new position?
Still growing.
Still.
Ukrainian legislation, Ukrainian business environment, highly complex, many faceted, lots of generalizations.
A very diplomatic way of putting it.
Yes.
Highly complex.
Highly complex, but also, and again, I think as we've discovered with the Ukrainian government during this war and other aspects, I think often having a worse reputation than it deserved in real life. So one of the things I learned in the first few weeks is that there are significant parts of the Ukrainian court system that actually work and that, you know, decide on tax cases, etc., within a reasonable period of time. And then sometimes the issue is that the court orders are not then implemented by the tax service and you need to persuade them, then they do. But that this notion that I think I'm going to go into dangerous metaphor territory here, sorry, but so many people use the burning platform argument from 2014 to 2021, arguing that things were probably so serious you needed to do something major, you needed to change it, you needed to have a big technical assistance program to fix it, and to get the money and to get the support, you needed to paint things as darkly and as horribly as possible. Now that physically the platform really is burning, literally here in Ukraine, people are realizing, well, actually, it's not as dysfunctional as we were saying. And also, you know, Ukrainians, are they really the poorest people in Europe? Or were they just statistically the poorest people in Europe? And instead, people from three times richer Russia come to Ukraine and say, wait a minute, I need to steal your washing machine because you're better off than I am. So there's a lot of assumptions that are being questioned and shifted by this war. And I think there's a sense, and I was lining up in Peremyshl at the train station with Ukrainians who'd been in a lineup for 2 hours, so they're not terribly happy, commenting on the fact that, you know, the world outside is not so amazingly better than life in Ukraine. And so, you know, some of these Europeans, they were saying, they're living in the Stone Age. Like, you can't do anything with your phone. In Italy, one guy was saying to another lady, he said, you realize you eat your meal and you get something written out on paper and you have to take it to this desk somewhere else in the restaurant. There's no QR code. There's nothing. So I think not just in terms of bravery, but in terms of what actually was achieved after 2014, but also in over 30 years, people now appreciate it differently, now that it's so threatened by overt destruction. Maybe just another little anecdote in this. I was also at one point doing a border crossing on foot and legally, I might add. I was not sneaking across the border.
Not crawling.
No. Medica Shehini, standing in line with a bunch of people from Kramatorsk, who had been evacuated from Kramatorsk, one earlier and others just a few days earlier, who were intending on going to Germany. And one of the things they said is, you know, it's so terrible. Kramatorsk, so much was done after 2014. Our city became so much nicer. And all of that is now being threatened and destroyed. But the thing is that until that threat came, you probably would have had a hard time finding people on the street if you did a vox pop in Kramatorsk in 2020 or 2021, saying, is your city nice? Nah, not good enough. It's only when it's threatened, you know, as one of my Canadian countrywomen, Joni Mitchell, said, you don't know what you got till it's gone. That's what's happening. Ukrainians are appreciating a lot of things about their country more.
Things that happen around change our perception of simplest things, of simplest words. And when you said, I said, or I would sit in my basement, you probably guess what I immediately thought of.
Yes.
Although I understood that you meant another thing, but the picture is here in your perceptions since the 24th of February this year.
Well, certainly my appreciation for Ukrainian bravery, which before was kind of abstract. Now it's very visible and very practical. I already sort of largely appreciated Ukrainians' sort of horizontal self-organization skills, but they certainly have come out very prominently. I would say also this kind of voluntary coming out of Ukrainian business and citizens and offering the state money, pay taxes in advance. I was talking today to an economist who pointed out that the famous FOPE, single person entrepreneurs, that a large number of them didn't take advantage of the offer February, March to shift from 5% taxation to 2% taxation. They, for patriotic reasons, said, no, I'll keep paying more so that the government has money for the army. So I think that that is a big change, because I think mistrust was traditionally the mode, both on the part of the people, business, and then the state in dealing with business and the people. So for me, it's that was a hugely hopeful moment. And my main concern is that we don't lose that moment now as things painfully but semi-normalize in many parts of the country. So it means government shouldn't go back to its bad old habits, and neither should citizens, and neither should business. Having sort of put everything on the table, I would rather see things kept on the table rather than being hidden away under the table.
One of the last questions, you say the government should not go back to bad old habits, and people, of course, should not. But aren't we in danger of acquiring some new bad habits because of the war?
I think there is naturally worry about authoritarianism, although I think the quest for strong leadership is natural at a time of conflict, and you don't want everything organized by consensus when there's no time for consensus to necessarily be evolved. I think there's enough resilience and resistance to that in Ukraine for it not to actually become a dominant feature. The trauma of simply hundreds of thousands of people seeing people being blown apart, body parts separated, etc., that's hard. And that will be a psychological burden for decades to come. Some people will find it easier to overcome. Others will find it more difficult to overcome. And then I think it's been interesting for me to read young, progressive Ukrainian journalists or activists writing about how they're concerned with managing their own hate. And coming to the conclusion, which I think is not unreasonable at this point, that right now they can't help but hate, given what's happening to their friends, to their family, given the nature of the enemy that has attacked Ukraine. But in the long term, how you sort of come down from that emotion and how you transform it into something more positive, that will be decisive for the country.
Roman Vashuk, Ukraine's business ombudsman and previously a very successful ambassador of Canada to this country, the guest of Ukraine Calling, a podcast, the English language podcast on Hromadsky Radio. Thank you very much, Your Excellency.
And it was excellent talking to you.